This week, the precious metals continued an impressive rebound on U.S. dollar weakness. Hello, everyone. Your host, Chris Walczek, back with you this weekend for another Muy Grande-sized show, including full-sized featured guest interviews and the top headlines affecting your portfolio. You know, it's been 3 years now since the precious metals topped. That's right, back in 2011, and here we are in 2014. But signs of a solid bottom are beginning to show up all over the charts. That is at least according to my first guest, and he should know, as a veteran quantitative investor and former Goldman Sachs proprietary trader, Charles Nenner of Charles Nenner Research Center uses the skills he honed there. His cycles work indicate that a bottom is likely in place for the sector. He uses sophisticated neural network models to remove human emotion from trading systems, enhancing returns. He's in the deflation camp because the herd is positioned for inflation. But gold remains an essential tool, he thinks, even in deflationary conditions, since virtually every other asset class will implode. And in the next 4 to 5 years, he does expect hyperinflation. This is just the best case scenario for gold bulls. He also shares a very interesting opportunity for investors interested in diversifying their portfolio. Our options and volatility traders will be interested in these comments. You'll want to stay tuned for the whole report. Next out of the bullpen, Wall Street wizard Peter Grandich says the stock and bond market rallies are overextended. Geopolitical concerns in Iraq, a nation that has 12 U.S. military bases, could catapult crude oil prices, sending inflation shockwaves across the globe. The Fed has been forced to shoulder most of the economic burden, but Congress just needs to step up and share some of that burden using fiscal measures. He agrees with Charles Nenner that inflation will return to the markets, making gold and silver the investments du jour. And Robert Ian wraps up the show with a must-hear editorial. Take just a few seconds here to share an important message with all my listeners. According to my favorite MD, Dr. Mark Hyman, one out of two Americans, that's 150 million of us, and that group includes me, are either diabetic, pre-diabetic, or on the path to either condition. But he offers a fantastic solution that we're utilizing here in the Walczek household with remarkable results so far. You can simply cut out as much sugar as possible from your diet. And you know, it's easier than you think. If you try to eat all your meals from home, you know, you stop buying sweet drinks, including diet drinks, including sodas, including fruit juices. Next, you can cut out all sweets. That's 100% sugary tomato sauces, ketchups, and condiments. You know, it sounds harder than it actually is. After about 7 days, 3 to 7 days, the cravings subside. And after 2 weeks, you'd be surprised at how your energy level increases. You just stop craving foods that your brain is addicted to. And just to give you an idea here, this has been proven in multiple studies. It turns out that rats, when given the opportunity, either addicted to sugar and cocaine, always choose the sugar over the narcotic. 7 to 8 times more addictive, sugar that is. So we're dealing with something here that is really sort of beyond our control. You'll watch your energy level soar and the pounds fall off. You know, if I could travel back in time 10, 20, even 30 years, I would tell myself, avoid sugar at all costs. As the good doctor and his functional medicine colleagues regularly say, if the food item has sugar on the label, toss it in the garbage. It's poison. I don't think they're exaggerating. I agree. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with the market weather report. Visibility was virtually unlimited over the precious metals exchanges this week on news that the U.S. dollar dropped to the lowest level in 2 months. At Friday's closing bell on the New York COMEX exchange, investors turned to gold, which added only $2 for the week, but still up to $13.12. The yellow metal is still higher for the year by about 6-7%. Silver gained 5 cents, just shy of $21. Palladium picked up 19, closing at $8.41. Platinum finished at $14.79, up $23. And West Texas Intermediate crude ended at $105.74 a barrel, losing about a dollar in change on slightly less tension in the Middle East. The top story sending the metals higher this week, news that the greenback dropped to a two-month low in the wake of worse-than-expected domestic economic reports, in particular that sluggish GDP revision. Gold has recorded the best rally in about 3 years. Mounting tensions in Iraq and Ukraine have investors, well, on edge, turning to the yellow metal. And it also has positive implications, I think, for crude oil and natural gas as supply disruptions become a real threat, as well as a potential hotspot for conflict between the current reigning global superpowers. For instance, on Friday, the European Union signed a trade deal, several deals actually, with three adjacent nations to Russia. According to a Wall Street Journal report, the Kodiak Bear Nation will likely view this move as retaliatory over the tensions with Ukraine. In China, 25 gold processors made a combined profit of more than 900 million yuan from loans. That's according to a report by the National Audit Office. China's chief auditor announced that $15 billion of loans backed by fraudulent gold transactions occurred. Although the news might put a slight damper on the gold price in the near term, increased awareness of the need to own physical gold over paper, I think, is likely to spur demand for the underlying metal in the long term. And I think this is key to breaking the manipulator's stranglehold on real, honest money, the precious metals. China recently earned the moniker of world's biggest consumer of gold, and the Rousing Tiger Nation is also the largest gold producer. Last week, the metals blasted higher on heels of dovish comments from Federal Reserve Chief Janet Yellen, as well as a similar decision by the ECB to push the benchmark lending rate into negative territory. Negative rates are the hallmark of gold bull markets, as outlined by Gibson's Paradox. Analysts are concerned that the Fed has painted itself into a corner due to excessive toxic mortgage-backed security purchases and balance sheet expansion, adding over $3 trillion with the QE programs. In other words, how will the anemic recovery persist without the QE panacea? Stay tuned. This is likely to get interesting for gold bulls. Meanwhile, after 3 years of tame price reports, inflation may be rearing its head with the consumer price index up 2.1% in May, food prices with the biggest increase in 3 years, and oil prices adding to price hikes, sending shockwaves through the petroleum-dependent economy on news from Iraq. Inflation typically accompanies higher precious metals prices. Bottom line on the yellow metal. Well, this week it was all about digesting the accommodative Fed and ECB. I think astute investors are asking themselves, what do the central bankers see that the investing herd might be missing? Could conditions in Iraq be far more unstable than believed? Or could the Ukrainian standoff foment a greater conflict? Or could both scenarios converge into World War III? For most investors, I think the answers to these questions are apparent only in the rearview mirror, and that's why we follow the price trends. Price reflects the opinions of the best investors who telegraph the future in higher highs and lower lows. Moving on to the Wall Street Report. Partly cloudy skies appeared over the New York Stock Exchange with two top benchmark indexes closing off of the highs, while the Nasdaq, though, bucked the trend, closing at yet a new record bull market high and the best showing since the year 2000 collapse. A downward GDP revision shifted funds from cyclically sensitive issues into the ignored Nasdaq sector stocks. For the week, the Dow was off just 95 points, ending at 16,851. The S&P dropped about 2 points, wrapping up at 1960, while the Nasdaq gained 30, ending at 4,397. The top story underlying the equities rally this week, positive news showing that consumer sentiment rose to 82.5, well above economist expectations for the June figure. This was viewed as highly positive as the economy is comprised of nearly three quarters of economic output. Actually, really good news, along with soaring new home sales. It supports the theme that the recovery is underway and the GDP revision was just an anomaly. Bottom line on Wall Street. Well, the seven-component sentiment index pendulum that we watch so closely remains in extremely enthusiastic mode despite the sluggishness this week. I view this as yet again another bearish sign from a contrarian perspective. The markets did pull back, as this index really told us they would, last week. Nevertheless, there were clear signs of accumulation in the Dow and the S&P this week, and we're well above most of the support levels. We're seeing some signs of pivot point showing up in the index as well. So I would say, for the meantime, we can remain cautiously optimistic. And for all the rest of the Alpha Stocks picks and the newsletters and next week's forecast, please log into your Alpha Stocks newsletter account or sign up. We'd like to have you on board with us. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio with investor superstars Charles Nenner and Peter Grandich. We'd like for you to stay with us right here at GoldSeek. Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Well, my featured guest today is founder in the field of quantitative investing, former technical analyst from Goldman Sachs. Charles Nenner is CEO of Charles Nenner Research Center. Welcome back, Charles Nenner.
Thank you.
Let's begin the discussion, if we could, with the precious metals. You know, in a Barron's article, you seem to note that, you know, we've seen this flight from paper gold, and particularly the ETFs, futures, options, and other derivatives. And that seemed to put some downside momentum on the metal. A lot of that appears to have been washed out of the system. What is your take on the current situation in the market?
Well, as you maybe remember, we went out at 1900 on gold when our cycle top and a price target was reached. And we said the next cycle low, the important cycle low, is in July 2014. And we started to nibble a little bit. We're long gold and we're long silver and gold stocks for the moment. But we say this is not going straight up. The first big move was some short covering rally. But we're getting close to the low that we were looking for, and we're looking for resumption of the bull market.
You know, that's interesting. You talk about cycle tops and cycle bottoms, and it's interesting that your forecast took you to 2014 because, I mean, that appears to be right on the nose. Can you offer any tips to aspiring young technicians listening to your voice today?
Well, if you go to my website, charlesnenner.com, there's a presentation there by one of my partners, Mr. Gurewicz, and they asked me, I was on the phone, because I retired in 1989 and came back to Goldman Sachs in 97. And was there anything that was interesting? I say interesting was that nobody made any headway. All the technical analysis is still the same as it was 20 years ago. It's drawing a little bit line, a little bit moving average, a bit of this, a bit of that. In the meantime, we have been building neural networks that really copy the human brain, leaving out emotions, why the computer does it much better. And we find patterns that the human eye can never find. But the original technical analysis just continues, you know, to say if it crosses this line, then it crosses that line, and it doesn't improve anything.
Folks worry sometimes, though, about expert systems. Actually, I was tinkering with neural networks back in my dissertation days in 1997, and a lot of people were concerned by the lack of human intervention. But it looks as though when you remove the emotional aspect that you were referring to, you actually can have better results. Care to discuss?
Yeah, much better results. For instance, we bought at the low in March 2009. Now, who had the emotional power to buy when the whole market was collapsing? Well, my computers had that, and we have been long since then. We just happened to sell out a week ago, so we don't have any positions anymore. We did very well. I was doing all the market timing for the prop traders of Goldman Sachs, you know, the people who invest their own money. And it has been proven to do very, very well. It's just very far from the reality, although he doesn't even look at it because he thinks it's too complicated for him, but it's not that complicated. It's just you need another look at the world. You need to look at the world that things don't happen at random.
Very good. Well, you know, you also note a peculiar quality of gold bugs that we think independently, sometimes outside of the box. We're a bit suspicious as a group of prevailing social mores and status quo. How would the gold aficionado, or how could we be vindicated in the next stage of the gold bull market?
A couple of things that people don't seem to notice. First of all, if you look at the last 500 to 700 years of economic expansion, then deflation is the norm, not inflation. And we talk about inflation because that's what we all remember, because, you know, we were in the markets when there was inflation, so deflation. Then the other thing is most bull markets in gold happen when there's a deflation, not inflation. Most people don't know that. So why when there's deflation? Because if there's deflation, there's almost nowhere to hide. The profits of the companies go down because people wait with buying because they think tomorrow get it cheaper. The real estate goes down. Bonds even go down. You saw in Greece what happened, the collapse of the bond market in Italy and France. So people hide in gold. But they're still talking about inflation, and I think we're in for deflation. And until we finish a real problem in deflation, we're not out of the woods.
I haven't heard any of my guests in almost 9 years. The analysts as a group will indicate that during the Great Depression, which is sometimes viewed as a deflationary episode, that gold did, as you say, hold up better, but it still lost some relative value.
Well, there were all kinds of rules and regulations, and people were afraid of the government, and I don't think the government will stand a step in this time because it's a worldwide market these days.
So this is an interesting twist, I think, to the plot when you start to talk about deflation making gold all the more interesting. Because, you know, during the last mini deflationary episode, let's say 2008, 2009, we saw money flow into the U.S. dollar as a safe haven, and certain treasuries, if memory serves, gold held up remarkably well.
It's interesting if you talk about it. If you go to my website, you look, for instance, at the 27th of December 2007, I talked about deflation, and I said, listen, that I talk about deflation is not so interesting. What's interesting is that I'm the only person in Wall Street for the last year that uses the word deflation, and that scares me, that nobody thinks out of the box. And I think we're having the same situation. In Europe, they have 0.4 level of inflation. Now, if you get a little bit weak economy, which we're going to get, you're around zero. And then you start exporting deflation because the euro refuses to go down. China is going to be a lot weaker. Japan soon is going to be in deflation again. And I don't hear anybody saying it. So usually I think I'm right when nobody else is pointing to a certain state of mind. So it convinces me that we still have to see a deflationary crisis, which, of course, will then lead to inflation because the Fed is going to make some major mistakes. And, of course, we're going to have hyperinflation, but that's going to take another 4 or 5 years.
This is going to be music to the ears of our listening audience today. If we start to talk about deflation, as I understand it, from what I've read on the central bankers, they're all terrified of deflation.
They are, because it's very hard to get out of it.
It is, and if I might tear a page from their playbook, one would expect for the central bankers in unison to follow the footsteps of their predecessors and simply fire up the printing presses, increase the money supply as much as possible, of course, absorb as much of the toxic debt as they can put on their balance sheets, and of course, this is all very inflationary. You seem to indicate that the end game could just be 4 or 5 years in front of us.
Yeah, but there's a problem over here. Like Roosevelt did the same thing. If you have inflation, if you calculate on every dollar that Roosevelt and his friends threw into the market, in the end, up to the 1940s, 45, they paid only back 18 cents on the dollar. So that was a good deal. The problem is if you have deflation, you go the other way around. And if you continue to throw in money, and you will have deflation for a couple of years, you have a big growth of your deficit. And the markets don't like that, and then you could be really in trouble.
Can you give us a possible outline of how the markets could react in that scenario?
Well, I think that Greece is a nice example. Cyprus is a nice example. Cyprus has set the example that the government just takes away your money out of your bank account. Now, that has never been shown before. So when one ship goes over the dam, then it's already a known thing. So it has been shown, and it went by pretty quiet. So it seems now that governments can just take money out of your bank account and say, I take away 20% of what you have in your bank account. So who knows what we can expect in a time of crisis.
You know, it's such an interesting point because you're right. The precedent has been set. We saw something similar. You mentioned Cyprus, Greece. Of course, we saw it in Poland as well, where the pension funds were raided. Some of this written into our legislation in North America as well. So it certainly is something I think that every investor needs to be paying attention to. You've got to find an unencumbered way to crystallize and secure your wealth.
Right, and that's why we have a very nice business going on, because we don't care if something goes up or down. We just want to tell you if it goes up or down. And if it goes up or down, we don't make any commission. We don't invest for people. We just tell them what to expect. That's honest, because I still don't think that most of the brokers have honest recommendations. They're still full of buy recommendations. If I open the television, they say, what do we buy today? Nobody sells, what do we sell today? What do we buy today? It doesn't matter. If it goes down, we have a buying opportunity. And nothing has changed.
You know, that's so true, because the retail investor is focused solely on the bullish side, the long side of the market. Typically, I think that is because they don't know much better. The gains can be so enormous with equities. So you can have a 5-10,000% move in a small low cap, low float equity. But you're right. Both sides of the market is where we find the smart money and the institutional money. You've got an interesting outlook the typical investor needs to hear. Are you worried at all that there are too many people on the sell the dollar theme?
No, I'm in the camp of the people who were saying we're looking for crash of the dollar. But for the last 15 years, I've said not now. But starting next year, it could be a problem. But I like to give an example of how you can make some money, if you want to know that.
Yes, sir.
Okay, so I will give you two examples. As you know, the volatility in the market is very low. It's like 10.5. Now, that is abnormally. Now, there are iShares that are leveraged 2 or 3 times. I think they're called UVXY. And the interesting thing is the out-of-the-money calls are very rich. Now, the I think that iShare on the VIX is trading like 32, 33. It goes very fast to 150 if something happens. So what you can do is you can buy something out-of-the-money 90 call, which I did, and I sold 165 call. It cost me 3.5 points, and I can make 70 points. Now, that I did till 2016. Now, nobody can tell me that volatility will not go up one time until we reach the middle of 2016. So I'm just waiting. And the other thing I told people to do is to buy the TBTs. Now, the TBTs is the opposite of TLTs. TBT goes up when interest rates are going up. And if I wrote in my articles, if you think that interest rates will always stay like 2.3, 2.4, then it's not for you. But if, like a normal person, you know, in a couple of years, they're going to be 4 or 5%, then you're going to make a lot of money on your TBTs. And it's a total hedge against inflation. So you have to think a little bit long-term and come with a little bit. Most people haven't heard about this, but this is how the insiders make their money. The volatility is very low. They start putting on call spreads. They're not in a hurry. They have 2 years to go. And on the bonds, they say, listen, it's not going to stay 2.4, 2.5. So I just wait.
It's so reminiscent of Nassim Taleb of Black Swan and Fooled by Randomness. The idea of look for those rare events and out of the money calls and puts, you know, where people are missing the opportunity. And, you know, you're right. Volatility has just been so low for so long. For our investors that might be intimidated by options and some of the nuances that are involved there, I'd suggest take a look at the VIX ETF, and you could always consider taking a long position there on a breakout.
Even if it goes to 9 for a couple of months, how low can it go? You understand?
The risk to reward is tremendous.
Tremendous. Nobody will tell me that the VIX will never go up for the next 2 years. That's like an impossibility.
What an interesting return to the mean opportunity. Charles Nenner, we want to thank you for your time. Just a true education here. Would you like to share any contact information with our listeners?
You can find us on charlesnenner.com. What you can do is you can write in. You get for a while, you get to research for nothing because we always convinced that it proves itself. We're now in for very interesting times, and I would advise for everybody just to take the research for free. And then after a couple of months, you get a phone call and people ask you, do you like it or you don't like it? But for the moment, you get it for free. And then you see exactly what all the insiders see.
Well, I want to encourage everyone to take advantage of this unique opportunity. Charles Nenner, thank you so much. We'll look forward to having you back on the show, sir.
Okay, till next time.
Market analyst Peter Grandich says that the bears could be losing their hold on this market. So it's a pleasure to have him back on the show. Market commentator for MoneyTalks.net. Hello, Peter.
Thank you for having me as always.
With the Dow and the S&P 500 now hitting all-time highs, we're seeing the FOMC comments from last week's meeting talk about holding the benchmark lending rate for another year at these lows. We're also seeing inflation beginning to heat up with the PPI and CPI inching higher. This sounds like good news for stocks, but even better news for the precious metals.
First of all, I would caution you, while we constantly hear about new record highs, these record highs are kind of within a fairly defined range. They are not spread out or much more percentage higher than they were just a few weeks ago. So while you hear that, it's not something that's made a lot of ground. Second of all, yes, some inflation is good for equities, and there's certainly no question that it's the lesser of two evils to equities that it is for bonds. Inflation is detrimental to bonds. I would be very cautious to say that is going to be a positive reason why the equity market continue going higher. In fact, I have been looking for now a top here between last Friday's triple reaching and the next employment report. And the reason the employment report is still significant, it's the last one where the government uses a variety of seasonally adjusted and other numbers to create a much better employment environment than really exists. And I think once that's out of the way, the reality of a rather weak economy and overpriced equity and very overpriced bond market and the inevitable turn up in interest rates is going to not bode well for financial assets, meaning equities and bonds.
You know, as of Tuesday, we've certainly seen a lot of volatility enter these markets. I told my subscribers and listeners last week that I was quite concerned by the excessive bullishness that we're seeing in the sentiment indicators here. We monitor that more closely even than price. We saw excessive bullishness to one of the most extreme levels that I've seen last Friday. Well, frankly, since this bull market began in 2009-ish, people were just euphoric and usually does not accompany new highs. During every single new high that we've seen on a weekly basis, since 2009, always been accompanied by very low interest by investors, strong bearish sentiment. But I also wanted to ask you about geopolitical tensions that are starting to ratchet up in the Middle East. And I'm sure you've heard about Iraq, one of the largest oil exporting countries still. Some concerns there that we've just lost one of the country's largest refineries to the insurgents. Could have a destabilizing effect or impact, I think, on the nation and the region, potentially. I don't know if you've heard, but several thousand Iranian troops have been sent into the region. We've sent over about 300 people to help stabilize things. Investors are concerned here, and I think justifiably so. The U.S. could send, you know, more troops, larger, you know, maritime fleet. I think we've even evacuated the embassy. I'd like your thoughts on this and just what it might mean for the markets, please.
I think on the geopolitical side of things, when it comes particularly to our equity market, those who have not been around, as you said yourself and myself, now in my fourth decade, have greatly discounted and believed that geopolitical concerns somehow no longer impact the markets in a negative manner. I think that's a very poor choice by those people and will come back to bite them. in this particular case, because it's in such an important part of the world where energy prices come from, and knowing that the world's economy at best in the last few years has been tempered, any significant rise in oil prices that are sustainable will cut into whatever's left of GDP growth. And so I think it's a very important thing to look at. But I think the other thing that escapes is the presidency, and literally there is no real foreign policy or nothing to point to, not only here in the country but abroad, that will say that this president and his administration has left its mark. Iraq is really a disaster. It wasn't too long ago that Vice President Biden was speaking openly about it. It was the mark of how great the Obama administration has done on foreign policy. And it's just no matter where you look around the world, there are geopolitical hotspots that can impact us all. So I just think that the only reason the president has not been terribly banged up in the daily rants of people is that the stock market has risen during his administration. Credit or not, I'm not here to argue that. But people have had a false sense that the economy has got to get better, even though it's not good for me right now, because look at the stock market, it's going up. So one day it's going to get better for me, so I'm not going to complain a lot at this point. And I think when the stock market turns down, and I think that time is coming, then the last bastion or the last rock that this president and administration could hide behind will be removed. And then all the half-empty viewpoints will come to the forefront, and that'll be a negative for financial assets but be a positive for hard assets.
I'd also like your thoughts on the Fed's latest from last week's meeting. You know, according to the Fed statement, beginning in July, they will add to their holdings of mortgage-backed securities at a slower pace than before. As we know, they dropped their stimulus by about $10 billion for the fifth time in a row. But what I find interesting here is this new verbiage they've added into the statements. This was brought to my attention by Navalier and Associates. They're going to reinvest some of these funds. And according to a couple of sources here, this term reinvestment may be the Fed's attempt at QE4. We're seeing their balance sheet continue to inch higher now. When I say inch higher, $4.4 trillion. It seems like just a few years ago it was at $800 billion. We've entered a whole new paradigm of money expansion here. This new sobriquet, reinvestment, a couple of inside sources are claiming that that is just camouflage for further Fed stimulus. I'd like your thoughts.
I find it impossible that there has not been more discussion. Well, I shouldn't say that, because in the financial journalism world, and most that we listen to from the main financial houses, are not going to talk about things that could be possibly negative. So I take that back, but I do surprisingly not find in the independent minds that are still out there that there's still such little talk about the record amount of what the Fed's balance sheet has gone to, and how do you unwind that without disrupting the markets. And I agree with you in this sense. I believe that the moment the markets turn down, and they turn down hard, and that is coming, the cries will go out for the Fed to put on its Superman uniform again. And one of the things they'll do is they'll go back into some type of quantitative easing mode. And it's not like we haven't seen this before. And I keep pointing this out to people. I think the United States has started down the road that Japan started back in the late 80s. And that is, you know, quantitative easing forever. And that is what has happened in Japan, and it's been stagnant. And I think the same is going to be true for America. There is no corner, because they've been painted into it, the Fed, and no one wants to go through. They had the opportunity in 2008 to allow for an unwinding of debt through a difficult, if not depressionary, type economy for a few years, and no one is willing to take that medicine here in the United States, and therefore the only avenue that will inevitably go down is an avenue that Japan went down. So I agree with you that there'll be some sort of QE, whatever they call it, or whatever way they disguise it. but it will come when the economy turns down and the market turns down. And once we're 10 to 20% from the highs and people, employment is not getting any better, it will be turned to the Fed. And what's really amazing about that, it's not worthy of a long discussion, is when I was in this thing 30 years ago, it wasn't the Fed that was looked upon to help and build the economy. It was Washington. It was always the Congress that would hopefully enact legislation and do things with regulation and what have you to build an economy, and not the Federal Reserve's job to maintain the economy. But like it or not, and I think it's partly its predecessor's fault, but the Fed chairman has become, because of Washington's inability really to be any effective anymore, has become the person group or in charge of the economy, and that isn't what their job was supposed to be. And so I agree with you that I just think that whatever they call it and however they disguise it, inevitably will go back to more and more reason. And that is the sniff that I believe has helped stabilize the decline in the precious gold market and has now given it a lift, and the fact that inflation, a word that has not been used in the market for years and years, is a reality again, and that the fears of deflationary environment are dissipating, and people are looking at the possibility of inflation. And in the end, people that forgot about it, that had been for many, many years one of the main driving forces for gold, and I think it's going to return as well.
Well, you make two fantastic points I'd like to touch on here briefly. Firstly, with regard to the former Fed Volcker, if you read his comments, he's been quite vocal with regard to the fact that we really require further fiscal. They have, as you said, shouldered the burden of responsibility for economic growth on the Federal Reserve. And as I think you also aptly point out, that is not their responsibility. The Fed's mandate was clearly just to maintain stable markets, and in particular, currency stability. The other thing you touched on, and I think this is really key here, it's the crux, a lost generation. Take a look at Japan. Well, there's a brilliant new study, and they make five or six fascinating points that I think are very salient to our economy today. The Great Depression here in the United States, as well as the lost generation in Japan. And they drew some startling parallels between what occurred in both instances and what is and could occur here in the United States, that people had to fall back on family. They had to be able to count on their high morality of the society. They had to fall back to those basic values on the family farm. Interview after interview of people still living today who had lived through the Great Depression, how we don't know what we would have done if we couldn't have fallen back to the family farm, you know, Steinbeck tradition of the grapes of wrath. If we keep with this idea and we move forward to the lost generation in Japan, what I thought was interesting is they talked about how we were able to graduate from school, sign up with a company, and we would work there for the next 30 or 40 years. And you could count on it. I mean, you were loyal to the company, and the company took care of you from cradle to grave. As the economic sea change came, then all the people graduating afterwards had nowhere to go because there were no jobs. They couldn't bring them on. They were already saturated, and then the whole system imploded. I think if we take those two situations, where is the morality? Where is the safety net for the typical American?
It's built on false hopes, and that's why the entitlement issue has gotten so out of hand. People have, in a sense, and I don't want to say that or begin to paint a picture that every single person on entitlement program doesn't want to work or what have you, but we have made it to a point of where it does call into question, should I work at such low income levels when affordably I could do as well, if not better, with a variety of entitlement programs at both the federal, state, and local level. And that is that's an issue that may not be spoken about each day, but because of some involved in civics, I can tell you is faced by local, state, and federal leaders, and people have, in a sense, become used to and expecting the government to do everything. And, you know, we had a big, terrible storm here a couple of years ago, Hurricane Sandy. There has been a feeling among people that the government is responsible to take care of everything and make everything that it was new. And I've argued and sometimes have gotten into some trouble with, because I live near the shore, of people saying that, you know, I think if someone decides to build a $6 zillion home with 3 feet away from the ocean, with not raised up, I don't think that my tax dollars should be spent to fix that home up again. If they wanted to do that and took their chances, that should be it. And it's just one of zillions of issues of where people have, in a sense, grown entitled to something. And my dad, who passed away in the late 80s, used to say that once people go from something that is really a gift to versus they believe it's an entitlement, it's hard, if not impossible, to take it back. And I just think we've gotten people conditioned to expecting government to be there, and government takes advantage of that by doing that and giving just enough to people to the point of that, well, I better keep these people in power because this is the only way this is going to continue for me. And that's the great argument. And there is a backlash growing. I will say this. There is clearly a feeling that throw the bums out, no matter what side of the aisle they're on, if they've been there a while, and start with somebody fresh. I think what took place in Virginia a couple weeks ago and today down in Mississippi and others, I think we're going to read about longtime both Democrat and Republican incumbents being tossed and being voted out by people with little or no political experience running in their place. I really believe there's a feeling, a movement in America, or throw the bums out, and I think it's going to increase, particularly, as I said, the last saving grace that has really stopped everything from unwinding has been the equity market, and the Fed knows that. There's no question that they know that, but inevitably, gravity will take hold, and when that time comes, all these other problems we just discussed are really going to come to the forefront.
I'm sure you've heard the expression that once folks learn that they can vote into office officials who will give them those entitlements, the system is doomed to collapse. And there's another interesting quote, I think, that follows here from Voltaire, who said, "Money always returns to its intrinsic value, paper money, that is, zero." In other words, it has no value. And so I think when we combine the two, and it's a vicious cycle, which I think you were alluding to, you know that once they open up Pandora's box, there's no way they can stop it. The only way to get elected is to promise more goodies, and the only way to stay in the office is increase the entitlement. Eventually, the music has to stop. The Federal Reserve Chairman, obviously, I think came off a little bit more dovish following the last meeting than many people expected. We saw the dollar rally get capped. The Fed is not offering any time frame on future rate hikes. Then they noted that there's no fixed algorithm in their decision regarding their benchmark lending rate.
My opinion on gold was that in the latter stages of major moves, either up or down, certain people pile in too late on that move. And in this particular case, there was a technical pattern a few months ago that had set up. It broke down. Everybody's mother seemed to have written that that meant that gold was about to collapse. A variety of people got very short, particularly the hedge fund community. They did not understand what we've talked about for quite a while, that the physical market has been getting stronger and stronger, and one day would override whatever the paper pushes do. I think that occurred. We saw, whatever the excuse may be, the Fed's comment, whatever it was, a tremendous short covering rally begin. Inevitably, big bear markets in any type of market, not just gold, begin off of short covering rallies because at the end of a bear market, everybody thinks, just as they do during a great bull market, that a way of making money, in this case, is to the short side, was caught. It turns the market around. It gives it a foothold that allow fundamentals to go from half empty to half full. That's what I think is happening in gold. But I think the difference in this gold rally than any gold rally that we've had for several years is as it starts to mature and start to work higher, I think inflation and inflation numbers are going to play a positive role on it. And I think people, it's still shocking to me. I'm amazed that the average person out there can go out and buy a 10-year bond for 2.62%. when they know everything they're paying for is raising, is going up in price far more than that. But I also think as they view that there's, to them, there's been no other alternative but to do that. But I think some of that alternative is going to be viewed in gold, as it was in the 70s. And people will start to use gold as an inflation hedge again, something that has not been spoken out a lot of amounts for a few decades.
The real interest rates are key here. And we've seen for years now this relationship hold up, high negative correlation between low rates and high gold prices. Larry Summers wrote a seminal paper on it that essentially showed that negative rates virtually guarantees a gold bull market. The ECB enters negative rate territory, the first major central bank to do so on record. I can't think of a more positive sign for the precious metals. Any thoughts?
Yeah, just a variety of things that make it strong. I want to point out that since the highs 2011, there's no question in my mind there has been a movement among certain groups, people, whatever they are, named or unnamed, to move the paper market down, hoping it would cause a tremendous capitulation in the physical market to allow large sums to come back to the people who are short that have lent out, and in a sense, what we saw recently in China, gave out, used gold more than once in selling it. And in this particular case, it hasn't worked for them. While they got the paper price down, they did not see large quantities of bullion come back, and now they've been caught. There's been enough media attention, although not any close to what it's deserving of, to problems of governments asking for gold and not being able to secure it. Ironically, last night, a story Bloomberg ran about how Germany suddenly has decided that, no, the United States, it's okay, the gold's there, we're not going to bother with it, and then suddenly, several hours later, have to retract that story because it wasn't true. I just think that was another planet story that's happened from time to time in hopes of causing a significant sell-off last night because the paper market's starting to get out of hand to them. We're not there yet. I still think, as I've said for months, we need to get above $1,400 in gold. I think we're getting there. I just think, again, that what has held the gold market together has been people's desire, particularly outside of North America, to own physical metals in lieu of paper currencies, and as well as for geopolitical concerns as well. And I just think that's growing. It's now getting a foothold in North America. We're starting to see people be interested in that and be concerned about that. And I think the combination of both now are going to have kicked off and started a new upleg for gold and silver.
No, it really is the only foxhole available. I mean, every municipality, every country, every family, and every individual, unfortunately, has to take that army-issued shovel and dig their own foxhole amid incoming munitions. The only opportunity you have to protect yourself against inevitable purchasing power erosion, the everyday person you talk to and the economic tutelage that they may have under their belt was so skewed in a system where information has been eroded as the U.S. dollar. People are just starving for the truth. They see their grocery bill soaring, cost of prescriptions going up. They know that their rent is going up, price at the pump. And just across the board, this is a universal theme. As you say, inflation is going to be a persistent problem for all investors and for just individuals who have very little to invest in. And if we look at the numbers, less than half of Americans apparently have access to $2,000 or more should an emergency arise. Now, there is some question whether or not that includes IRAs and retirement funds. But my point simply is that people just don't have access to a lot of money because for the most part, they're living paycheck to paycheck or in the worst case scenario, playing a game of musical credit cards. Peter Grandich, any other topics that you'd like to leave with the listening audience?
I'll just say that earlier in our conversation, one of the points I wanted to get across, and I should have, and I'll do that to close, and that is, in a planning business that we have here, and it reaches out to North America with an associate up in Canada, there's a complacency that has overtaken most people. People either have felt that they have missed this market and therefore they wish not to do anything, or they're in the market and just feel it's going to continue to go forever and not be concerned about changing environment. And that complacency combined with what you said earlier about how basically seemingly all the bears have disappeared from the equity market and there was an overriding of bullishness is the classic mood environment that takes place just before a significant event or events happen to radically change that. So if there was any time we have spoken that I am as close to convinced of a market move, and not, I don't want to say the word guarantee because I've learned that after three decades you can't, but if ever we've been close to a significant change in a market, the equity market is that market, and all these signs that we just spoke about are screaming for those of us who've experienced it before that this is the classic telltale signs that take place before that happens. So I really feel that it won't be too long. It certainly won't be, we won't need to see snow again before we will be talking about a substantial decline in the equity market as far as I'm concerned.
All the dominoes are lined up, I mean, in a row. I mean, we've just had one of the more spectacular rallies in years, and eventually, at some point, that's more than likely going to have to come to an end. And, you know, really now that the Fed has, in some ways, I think, put the brakes on the economy, you have to wonder just what's going to sustain this. Corporate profits are beginning to slide, and as we know, that really is the engine. I think one of the things that's helping to hold things up right now, we have a very, according to the government, at least their numbers, a solid job market. And as you know, the consumer makes up over 70% of the economy. So they're feeling a bit euphoric for the most part, and they're spending what they're earning. But what they may have forgotten is that most of those jobs are low-paying jobs relative to pre-Great Recession 2008. When times do get tough, it's going to just, I think, exacerbate the situation all the more. Peter Grandich, give folks an idea how they can find out about your work, please.
One, I write for moneytalks.net, one word, moneytalks.net, and our planning business is Trinity Financial Sports and Entertainment Management. It's too long to describe the website to you, but I'm sure people can reach out to you and you can forward to us if they have any interest.
This is must read every day. Bookmark Peter's website, inspirational quotes, all kinds of great ideas. And, you know, he just puts it out there for everybody. So, you know, this is must have information. We're going to look forward to having you back on the show, sir.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Hey, Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. An article at FinancialPost.com titled Moody's Cuts Outlook for Canadian Bank Debt to Negative Over Bail-In Regime is an important alarm bell and reminder of what happened in Cyprus and what is likely to happen on an even larger scale in larger countries on an institutionalized, premeditated basis when the global financial mechanism has a major implosion or grinds to a halt. It's no secret governments around the world are implementing bail-in provisions to avoid taxpayer-funded bank bailouts. This week, Moody's Investors Service in Canada changed the outlook from stable to negative on some of the senior debt and uninsured deposits of Canada's seven largest banks. Moody's did affirm the long-term ratings of the banks, but took the action on the supported senior debt and uninsured deposit ratings in what they called the context of previously announced plans by the Canadian government to implement a bail-in regime for domestic, systemically important banks. Moody's also cited an accelerating global trend towards reducing the public cost of future bank resolutions. As we know from the bail-ins in Cyprus, those resolutions can be costly endeavors for customers and investors who are unprepared. Back in 2013, the Canadian government made it clear that taxpayers would not be on the hook in the unlikely event that a Canadian bank needed to be bailed out. According to the vice president in the Financial Institutions Group at Moody's, the government's objectives are to spare the public purse. Senior debt holders would take a hit before taxpayers would. But of course, he never said that taxpayers wouldn't take a hit, only that they wouldn't be first. Some are touting the fact that Canada's banks weathered the 2008 financial crisis better than many of their global counterparts. That's being mentioned now as a backdoor mechanism to garner some kind of indirect support for this process. Frankly, it's irrelevant. Past results are no indication of future performance. Rating agencies took a lot of heat for not sounding the alarm bells leading up to the 2008 economic crisis, especially in the housing market. The article concludes that, for the time being, Moody's has left assumptions of very high systemic support outside the banks in place. However, the change in outlook reflects the possibility the ratings agency may reduce these assumptions in the future as details emerge about how Canadian bail-ins will actually work. It's time to listen carefully to what Moody's is actually saying, even indirectly, because I am very certain they, and others like them, will not want to bear the total blame of the wealth confiscation known as bail-ins when they are finally implemented. Remember, they never said that Canadian taxpayers wouldn't take a hit, only that they wouldn't be first. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. Reminding you to follow us on Twitter at Conquer Change. Thanks, Chris.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of Gold Seek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.